Now, every family has their bedtime rituals. For us, growing up, we had our two teas, teeth and toilet, and then a story would be read to us before lights out. Now, Karen and I have done something similar with our kids. When I put May to bed, I read her a short story or two. However, if it's a bit late, instead of reading her a storybook, I'll tell her a quick Bible story. Now that she's a little older, she likes to try and guess who the main character is, so I don't say the person's name as I tell it. Now, a few years ago, I was thinking of a quick story I could tell May before she went to sleep. And it randomly occurred to me that I had more familiarity with the characters of the Old Testament than the stories of the New Testament characters. Now, after saying goodnight to May, I thought some more about my familiarity with the New Testament. And as I pondered the gaps in my knowledge, I realized that there was quite a few. But in particular, I felt I didn't have a good grasp on all the various events of Jesus' life. I felt I knew some of the events, parables, teachings, quite a few even. However, I couldn't map them well. I didn't know their sequence, nor the surrounding events leading up to each. Nor could I say that I had deeply thought about all of them. And so over the past few years, I've tried to give a bit more attention to the life and story of Jesus through various means, whether my own reading, what I listened to, or my own study and research. I wouldn't say I've turned a corner in my retained knowledge, but there has been some interest. It's been interesting to see how much it's renewed my appreciation for the incredible insight, wisdom, and love of Jesus, the son of Joseph, as he would have been known. So today I'd like to focus on just one passage of Scripture that captures an interaction between a group of Pharisees, Jesus, and his disciples. This passage is powerful in that it touches on a narrow range of topics that are just as relevant and controversial today as they were in Jesus' time, although perhaps with a different twist. As I studied and prepared this message, I realized increasingly that contained in these 12 verses is some pretty heavy stuff. Things that the disciples struggled to understand, things that I struggled to understand. And so it's important to say from the outset that what I'm sharing today is aimed at introducing a topic for consideration and discussion, and it's not to claim the final word. So today I'd like to use this short yet impactful passage of Matthew to explore some of Jesus' thoughts about the ideas of divorce, the role of law, marriage, and singled unmarried life. So let's jump right in and read the entire passage, and then we'll step through it in more detail. So this is Matthew 19, from 1 to 12. So I'll read through it all, and then we'll come back and step through relevant pieces. Matthew 19, starting verse 1. Now it came to pass, when Jesus had finished these sayings, that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judah beyond the Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" And he answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he who made at the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh?' So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate." And they said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" And he said to them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery." And his disciples said to him, "If such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "All cannot accept the saying, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who are born thus from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who are made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it." Like I said, a pretty powerful passage. But let's start to unpack it. So Jesus had been teaching in the region of Galilee, in and around the city of Capernaum, which is on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Now, the Sea of Galilee, today called Lake Tiberias, is in the northern part of Israel at the base of the Golan Heights in the border region between Israel and Syria to the east. Capernaum is where Jesus lived and spent most of his time. From his baptism to the last weeks of his life, the Gospels are largely talking about events and happenings in around Capernaum. We pick up the story with Jesus having left the Galilee region on his way to Jerusalem, usually about a five-day journey by foot. Now, many people, likely from his hometown, have followed him on his journey, including his disciples. He heals those in need along the way, and so the crowd that left with him continues to grow. News would have spread far and wide of this procession, this great multitude of people following this man, Jesus of Nazareth, on the road to Jerusalem. Now, this journey for Jesus was of particular gravity to it, as he had left his hometown for the last time. He knows that he will never return. He knows that he will suffer and die when he arrives in Jerusalem. Every step that Jesus takes on this journey is one step closer to his terrible end. And I'm sure he was reflecting on the meaning and purpose of his life during this trip, giving even greater thought and a sense of urgency to what he spoke and taught to those that followed him. And as he journeys, he turns east and crosses the Jordan River, travels through the region of Perea on the eastern side of the river, which is today in modern-day Jordan. The Jewish leaders would have no doubt heard of his coming and the crowds that followed him. They sent delegations from Jerusalem to meet him on the road, perhaps to see if they could turn the crowds against him or just gather material that they could use against him when he arrived in Jerusalem. They sought to probe him and trap him into saying something that they could use against him. And so the Pharisees see their opportunity in challenging Jesus on the topic of divorce and remarriage, a controversy that they sensed Jesus had a particular view on the topic of divorce and marriage, a particular view on that could present and easily make him stumble, because the law was on their side. It is in this context that we find Jesus having to respond to the Pharisees' questioning. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? It's a loaded, fully primed question, and yet Jesus meets it head on. Their follow-up question is also just as loaded. Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? Now, where did these questions come from? And what was the law that they were referring to about giving a certificate of divorce? Now, believe it or not, of the 613 odd laws in the Old Covenant, only one mentions divorce directly, with one other touching on it as well. And we'll read that in a bit. Well, let's first read the specific law the Pharisees are quoting in Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy 24. Starting in verse 1. Suppose a man enters into a marriage with a woman, but she does not please him because he finds something objectionable about her. And so he writes her a certificate of divorce. He puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house. She then leaves his house and goes off to become another man's wife. And then suppose the second man dislikes her, writes her a bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house. Or the second man who she married dies. Her first husband, who sent her away, is not permitted to take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that be abhorrent to the Lord, and you shall not bring guilt on the land that the Lord your God is giving to you as a possession. So you can see that this law isn't really about defining the grounds of divorce. Rather, it's about governing remarrying after divorce. Namely, that once a couple has been divorced and the woman has remarried, she cannot remarry her original husband, even if she once again is divorced or her new husband dies. When you think about this, this law is pretty obscure law. It's one that's unlikely to come into effect very often. Excuse me. Being as that may be, the pivotal law that the Pharisees were drawing attention to is found in the first sentence and centers around the meaning of one word. Suppose a man enters into a marriage with a woman, but she does not please him because he finds something objectionable about her, and she writes her a certificate of divorce. The key word here is the Hebrew word that is translated objectionable. In other translations, it is indecent or uncleanliness. Literally, it means nakedness. Now, it's a strange technical legal term that's very hard to know exactly what is meant by it, even to the Jews. And therefore, there was a debate amongst the Jewish scholars about what this word meant. The Talmud talks of a dispute between two schools of thought about the meaning of this passage, which occurred about a generation before Jesus. So well before Jesus, we had this dispute. The school of Rabbi Hillel believed and taught that this word meant anything that the husband didn't like, anything he found objectionable about his wife, her behavior, her looks. Even if the wife burnt the husband's food, then he could give her a certificate of divorce. The other school that followed Rabbi Shammai taught that this word had a narrower meaning, and it meant only in cases of sexual misconduct by the wife could a divorce be issued. Now, it's pretty clear which of these two ideas had been fully adopted by the time Jesus and the disciples were born. This is why the disciples were perplexed, even a bit scandalized, at the idea of marriage where divorce could only happen in the case of adultery. The idea that divorce could occur purely due to the displeasure of the husband had permeated the entire society. The Pharisees sought to trap Jesus because they knew that the law was on their side. It's worth stopping and thinking about this for a little while. Just think about how vulnerable this law, interpreted this way, made married women, and by extension, all women in that society. Just imagine what type of culture this would foster. What place women would hold within it. Women were dependent on their husbands for social standing down to the bare essentials of life. And yet the law, interpreted this way, provided no protection for them, no security in the marriage covenant, no reciprocal obligation. Now instead, this law purely gave breath to the whims of her husband's displeasure. It protected the man's right to discard and to dismiss his wife for all or any reason, like a piece of property. And women had no such reciprocal right. It's perhaps hard for us to imagine such a level of accepted inequality in a society, but it really shouldn't be a surprise. You don't have to be a historian or an academic to know that all through history, across nearly all cultures, women have been oppressed in some form or other. According to Thought.com, oppression is the inequitable use of authority, law, or physical force to prevent others from being free or equal. Oppression is a type of injustice. It is no wonder that this reality has warped even the notion of marriage. Here we see that in the first century Jewish culture, just like so many other cultures before it, marriage was an institution that was primarily to please men. No one believes that polygamy was an idea dreamt up by a woman. No one believes that the broad interpretation of this particular divorce law was defined this way by women for women. And we don't like talking about this very much. It makes us feel a little bit uncomfortable, and it probably should. Historically, marriage has indeed been, in many cultures, an institution primarily for the pleasure of men, and not as God defined it or intended it. Jesus knew this, and I'm sure his anger was palpable at what he saw these Pharisees were doing and perpetrating, over and above them just simply attacking him. Indeed, oppression of women in marriage and more broadly has been such a constant feature of the human condition that we must ask ourselves, how much has this societal and historical reality has permeated our own understanding of marriage and the role of women? And we should not kid ourselves that we're immune. I must admit, it makes me squirm a little. I wonder if we did an anonymous poll of all the women in our church, asking them if they felt that they had a role in marriage and more broadly within the church, a role that was defined as God intended, or would they instead feel that their role was largely one defined by men? I honestly don't know what the answer would be, but it's worth thinking about. God knew that marriage would become an institution to primarily please men, and so he put limits on it, even in the Old Covenant. So let's now turn to another law I mentioned that touches on this topic. What is fascinating about this law is that it appears to have no historical bearing, nor does there appear to be any evidence that this law was ever used to establish obligations within marriage or to provide the grounds for divorce in the Jewish culture, despite it speaking explicitly to that. Two laws that touch on the idea of divorce, and yet only one has been a source of reference, with the broadest interpretation and most beneficial to men winning the day. It's hardly a surprise. Let's look at this law in Exodus 21. Exodus 21. Verse 10. Exodus 21, verse 10. If he takes to himself another wife, he must not reduce her food, that is his first wife's, her clothing or her conjugal rights. But if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go free for nothing without payment of money. No need to pay the bride price back. This law seeks to minimize the negative impacts of a polygamous marriage. Marriages that are prone to men acquiring and discarding women like property, which we know happened in many cultures and happens even today. This law seeks to protect the dignity of women in marriage. This law curbs the excesses that God knew would permeate and distort marriage. This law says that if a husband consistently neglects his wife in not providing food, clothing, and sex, three obligations in marriage, then he has broken the marriage covenant and the woman is no longer bound by it. The wife's divorce does not end the marriage. Rather, it's the husband's neglect that has ended the marriage. Just imagine the difference in societies if this reading of the law had become the guiding principles for marriage and divorce down through history. But even this law, because it was given in the context of polygamy, still does not capture the essence of marriage. And therefore, it is not a law that Jesus references in his reply to the Pharisees, even if it hints at the same point. But before we dig into how Jesus defined marriage, I'd like us to first drill into an assumption that Jesus challenges a premise that the Pharisees brought to every interaction and confrontation with him. So let's go back to Matthew 19 and read the relevant verses. Matthew 19, we'll pick it up in 7 and 8. Matthew 19. So they said to him, "Why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" And he said to them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so." Jesus challenges the assumption that the law given to the Israelites at Sinai represents God's moral ideal for mankind. This divorce and remarried law was an institution because of the corruption of men. And so God allowed a law to curb the excesses, a law that would still maintain the purpose and intent of the entire body of law, but not one that would frame the basis of an ideal marriage. This was a key difference in how Jesus understood God's law compared to the Pharisees. God gave the law to the Israelites to meet them where they were at, a nation that had suffered slavery for centuries in Egypt, a nation whose land would be surrounded by extremely immoral and godless nations. God gave them this law for their own benefit and good as a nation. We see this in Deuteronomy 5:33. "Walk just as he has commanded you so that you may live, that it may go well with you, and that you may live long in the land you are going to possess." He also gave it to them to set them apart from the nations around them. We see this in Deuteronomy 28:1. "If you indeed obey the Lord your God and are careful to observe all his commandments I am giving you today, the Lord your God will elevate you above the nations of the earth." God also gave it to inspire and to teach other nations of God, of his power and his love. In Deuteronomy 4, verse 6, "So be sure to do them, because this will testify of your wise understanding to the people who will learn of all these statutes and say, 'Indeed, this great nation is a very wise people. In fact, what other great nation has a God so near to them like the Lord, our God, whenever we call on him? And what other great nation has statutes and ordinances just as these of this whole law that I am about to share with you today?'" And finally, he gave them the law so that they could see that they needed a Savior. We see this in Galatians 3:24. Therefore, the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ, so that we may be justified by faith. It was laws like the one on divorce, this one on divorce, that should have been like a bright flashing light or an alarm going off, clearly showing that the law, even these laws from God, could not be the final answer. However, the Pharisees could not see this. Indeed, they refused to see it. Instead, they were convinced that to live in accordance with God's law was to achieve the moral ideal. Jesus' reply would have completely floored them. He was telling them yet again that their view of the law was fundamentally wrong. That the law arose not to map the moral idea, but rather to curb the excesses of their hearts. It is a profound insight and clarity of thought that Jesus here expresses. We see this same premise challenged by Jesus time and time again in his teachings. The moral ideal is not to be found in simply not murdering somebody. It is to be found in not hating another. The moral idea is not to be found in simply not committing adultery. It is to be found in not even looking at a woman a certain way. The moral idea is not to be found in the tithing of mint and cumin. It is to be found in justice, mercy, and faithfulness. The moral idea cannot be found in the law. It can only be found in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus the Christ. Do we believe this? Is this the foundational belief that we hold? Are we fundamentally different from the Pharisees? Do we completely reject their notion of the law and their thoughts on its role and purpose? The law given to the Israelites at Mount Sinai was like a signpost pointing in which direction to go. It was not the destination. It was a teacher that dealt with their carnality, curbing and limiting their excesses while providing a basis for relationship with their Creator God. What it did not do is define God's intent and purpose for the moral idea, a truly godly life. It was simply a first step. The moral idea would instead be defined by the fullness of the love of God and love of fellow man, as only truly exemplified by Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus was showing the Pharisees this reality. He was telling them that they were even missing this first step by using the law that they were about divorce, using it in this way. In his reply to the Pharisees, Jesus establishes the core basis for understanding the marriage relationship. It is to be found in the very beginning, not in the law at Mount Sinai. Let's read that in Matthew 19, verse 4, in that section of the Matthew 19 passage. Verse 4. And he answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together let no man separate." Jesus brings everything back to the very beginning. He's saying, if you want to understand marriage, then you need to go back to the initial purpose and intent that God had when he created humanity. Jesus says to the Pharisees, "Have you not read?" These were biblical scholars. Of course they knew these words. Jesus is frustrated at their willful ignorance. Jesus refuses to enter into the particulars of the debate about the meaning of the law that the Pharisees referenced, about the technical legal meaning of the terms and used instead, he sweeps it all aside and points to the very beginning when divorce had no place. Let's turn to that passage that Jesus quotes from, which is on the very first page of the Bible, in Genesis 1, verse 26. Genesis 1, 26. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, after our likeness, so they may rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, over the cattle and over the earth, and over all the creatures that move on the earth." And God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God he created them. Male and female he created them. So when Christ says he made the male and female, he's bringing this whole passage to mind. It was not that the male was made in the image of God and then female in the image of man. No, God says Adam, which is the Hebrew word for humanity, humankind, not just the male, humanity was created in his own image. One Adam, one species, one humanity made up of two equals, male and female, two separate genders that would have physiological and psychological similarities and unique differences, and yet together would be humanity. Indeed, this two-gender aspect of humanity was not unique in God's creation. Animals would also share this kind of distinction within species, but there was something unique about what this meant for humans. So let's read Jesus' next quote, which is just over the page in Genesis 2:22. Then the Lord God made a woman from the part that he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. And then the man said, "This one at last is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. This one will be called woman, for she was taken out of man. That is why a man leaves his father and mother and unites with his wife, and they become a new family," or become one flesh. One male, one female would each leave their own families and would enter into a marriage covenant of love by which they would become one and from which new life would come. It is this that is a reflection of the image of God. It is this that sets us apart from the animals. When Jesus says, "Have you not read?" he is saying, when you understand marriage in the context of it being a reflection of God's image, now you can talk about divorce. These two passages give the foundational knowledge to how we can navigate the controversies and challenges that arise over the intent and purpose of marriage. This idea is just as relevant today as it was in Jesus' moment of controversy presented to him by the Pharisees. Jesus is teaching us that if we understand what humans are, what marriage is, we will know how to weather these types of social storms. We will know what view to take and how to follow God's way, even in our own time. In the beginning, one humanity was created in the image of God, an image of God that was made up of two, one male, one female, that would become one through marriage and through which new human life would be generated. This is a divine image. It is this that reflects the image of God, God who himself is a love covenant being. One becomes two, becomes one, becomes many. This is what sets humanity apart from the animal kingdom. It is in the animalistic instincts of humankind to not do this, but rather to follow their innate passion and desire, instinct and impulse, to simply follow the chemical responses that all animals have. But this is not the image of God. Rather, it is to have one male leave his father and mother and to leave his family and join with one female to form a new family, a new wellspring of life. A marriage within which sex is contained, where one male, one female have committed to the higher calling of a monogamous covenant promise between them. It is this covenant of love that is a reflection of God's covenant love, a reflection of his image. Therefore, Jesus says to the Pharisees, only a betrayal of that covenant love, a breaking of that oneness through adultery, can the actions of a woman come to the level that breaks that covenant bond and a divorce be issued. Only then can a man divorce his wife. The betrayal of oneness that sexual immorality causes is why God equates adultery to idolatry. To worship another god is to destroy the oneness that God has with his sons and daughters. Both adultery and idolatry destroy covenant love. This is heavy stuff. Jesus' words to the Pharisees would have landed like knockout blows to them. Jesus elevated the marriage covenant to such a high level that it was scandalous to those that heard him. How could marriage be such a thing of equality, a thing that was the extension and reflection of the very image of God? The gravity and impact of what Jesus was saying hit the disciples hard. Perhaps it was even better to not even go there. If marriage was indeed such an unbreakable union, if it was a cohesive part of what it meant to reflect the image of God, maybe you're better off not get married. Christ responds in Matthew 19, verse 10. disciple said to him, verse 10, if such is the case of the man with his wife, it's better not to marry. And Jesus says to them, all cannot accept this saying, but only to those to whom it has been given. He's saying, you're right, guys. This ain't a walk in a park. This ain't an easy thing to do. Tread carefully. Only those whom it's meant will grasp it. Now, before I get into the final aspect of what I'd like to cover today, it's worth recapping where we are at in the conversation that Jesus is having. The Pharisees have come to him with a Jesus trap, a trap where they believe the law is on their side and they have a position that is consistent with the age-old reality of men oppressing women, where marriage is there to please men. Jesus responds by squarely positioning the law as being necessary because of the hardness of their carnal nature. And so he completely undermines their entire religious presumption that the law defines the moral ideal. He then proceeds to point back to the beginning, to the original of the origin of all law, when God created humanity in his image. When he created them male and female, one species made up of two that would become one in a marriage covenant. And from this union, new life would emerge and a new family would grow. The undeniable equality and mutual responsibility inherent in this union was self-evident. Jesus positions this as being a reflection of God's image that nothing should break apart. Only in the extreme cases of adultery, where the oneness of the covenant love is shattered, can a man divorce his wife. The Pharisees' presumption that a man could divorce his wife simply because she did something that displeased him, their presumption that they knew and understood the deepest aspects of God's way found in the law, was smashed by Jesus' insight and appeal to the first pages of Genesis. From this, you would think that the conversation was over. Asked and answered. The Pharisees' trap had been sprung and mud was on their faces. Jesus had once again floored them with his true knowledge and understanding. But Jesus was not finished. Jesus had not finished sharing his more complete vision of humanity. Although now his attention is no longer with the Pharisees, rather now he's talking with his disciples, following on from their response in their response to the gravity of marriage. Let's pick it up again in verse 10 of Matthew 19. And his disciples said to him, if such is the case of the man with his wife, it's better not to marry. But he said to them, all cannot accept this saying, but only to those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who are born thus from the mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it. Jesus has just laid down the strongest and most compelling argument for marriage being a normative reality of being human, of it being a reflection of God's own image, and then he decides to talk about eunuchs. Eunuchs. And not only that, but he establishes it as a valued and worthwhile alternative to marriage. Indeed, Jesus is not just talking about eunuchs in a technical sense, but rather in a broader sense of someone who is single, someone who lives a life without sex. This whole idea is anathema to us in our society today. Everywhere we look, it's clear that our society values sex above pretty much everything else. I'm sure if an alien life form landed in America, they would quickly conclude that sex is the meaning to life for these earthlings. Even the idea that life is about the pursuit of happiness lays down the foundation for sex being a central part of a happy and meaningful life. It is no wonder then that all forms of sexual relationships, sexual identity, are interwoven into people's view of happiness and a life of value and worth. Even our own take on marriage can take on aspects of this view, where marriage becomes the focus and only means for a happy life, because only in marriage is sex legitimate. This view of the value and importance of sex is here challenged by Christ. For Jesus, life is about much, much more than that. Such that a life well lived, full of meaning, value can come through a life absence of sex. It is a life that he chose, a life that many of his followers would choose. It is interesting that it is life's choice, in his life's choice. Sorry, it is interesting that it is this life's choice that we don't talk very much about, if ever. It says, look at this idea of eunuchs that Jesus is talking about a bit more. Throughout history, it's been a common practice across many cultures that kings would castrate males in their service to ensure that they would present no threat to the king's lineage and legacy. These are the eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men that Jesus cites. But Jesus also includes two other categories, also using the word eunuch, but now clearly no longer in a technical sense. He talks of those that were born eunuchs and those that chose to be eunuchs. In Matthew 19, verse 12, we can read it. If we read it in the complete Jewish Bible, it gives a bit more to it. Verse 12, For there are different reasons why men do not marry. Some because they were born without the desire, some because they have been castrated, and some because they have renounced marriage for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Whoever can grasp this, let him do so. In using the word eunuch to describe these three categories of singledom, Jesus is maintaining the reality that outside marriage, there is no place for sex. Marriage between a male and a female is the only place for a sexual relationship, their foundational structure for developing a family. However, Jesus is bringing this to the attention of the disciples. In this context, he is legitimizing the single life as one that also reflects the image of God, of life that has just as much meaning and purpose as one that involves a wife and kids. It is a reflection of the image of God because Jesus himself renounced marriage and children for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. I wonder if this choice was also an aspect of why Jesus showed such compassion and love towards women and children during his ministry. He's describing himself. He's describing the choices that he made as the perfect image of God. I wonder if Jesus was reflecting on these life choices as he responds to his disciples and gives them insight and understanding about married life and single life on his final journey to Jerusalem. Using the Pharisees' challenge as means to encourage and broaden his disciples' thinking about life and the meaning to it. Although marriage is a normative aspect of a meaningful life, it's not the only one. It's not the only one that reflects the image of God. Jesus not only speaks of his own situation, the choice that he made to put the kingdom of heaven first instead of marriage, but he also draws attention to those that have been physically made eunuchs but against their will. They are no less human. They have not missed the opportunity for a meaningful and a God image reflecting life. I'm sure these would be strong words of encouragement to those in this predicament. And Jesus does not stop there, but he also includes those that are born this way, born not desiring the normative marriage relationship. I think there's no controversy in saying that I believe this is where Jesus factors in people that are born with no sexual desire or also those with same-sex attraction. These things are not inhuman or evil. These things are simply part of the state we find ourselves in. Jesus frames a life of these eunuchs, these metaphorical eunuchs, that is just like his own, one that is without sex, but one that is a true reflection of the image of God, a fully complete and meaningful life, a life of one loved by God, a single life dedicated to the kingdom of heaven. It is to our detriment that we have not, in my church experience, fully embrace the idea of a single life dedicated to the kingdom as a legitimate, valued, and deeply appreciated meaningful life. A person whose life can enrich our own with wisdom, insight, and depth of understanding that can only come through living an unmarried life in this way. It is this value that Paul explores in more detail in 1 Corinthians 7. We won't turn there, but Paul also was a man who chose to follow Jesus by not marrying. Indeed, there are many, many examples in the Bible. And yet, if we're not careful, we can start to believe that the only path to fulfilling God's intent for humanity is through marriage and having a family. Although that is a normative one, it is not the only one. A single life dedicated to the kingdom is just as meaningful and also a true reflection of the image of God. Even if because of physical reasons, reasons of attraction or desire, or simply by choice, a single life is a meaningful and valued life exemplified by Jesus himself. Okay, let's wrap this up. Today we've stepped through a single passage of Scripture that captures an interaction between the Pharisees, Jesus, and his disciples on the road to Jerusalem. An event that happened near the beginning of Jesus' final journey, one that he knew would end with his suffering and death. It is in these final days that Matthew captures events and words uttered that have a gravity and importance, heightened by the finality of Jesus' life's journey. The teachings of Jesus given during this time are ones that we should deeply reflect on and consider. This is what I've tried to do today, bringing attention to this one short passage. From it, I extracted four powerful ideas that stem from this particular passage of only 12 verses. That we live in a world that all throughout history, across nearly all cultures, women have been oppressed in some form or other, both in marriage and more broadly within society. This reality is typified by the Jewish controversy that started prior to Jesus, but had been fully embraced by the society that he and his disciples grew up in. A society that viewed marriage as being for there to please men, and therefore the divorce laws given at Sinai should be interpreted in the broader sense, empowering men to lawfully dismiss their wives for any and all reasons, with no reciprocal rights or protection for the women. The disciples struggled to see it, questioning the viability of marriage in this new context, as defined by Jesus. We need to make sure that we understand marriage and the role of women in a way that is consistent with God's original purpose and intent for humanity. I then digressed and talked about how Jesus viewed the law in a way distinctly different from the Pharisees, in that they saw it as capturing the moral ideal, whereas Jesus saw it simply as a necessary to curb the hardness of their hearts. Therefore, for Jesus, it was not from the law which we should consider the basis and nature of marriage. Rather, it was from the very beginning from which we should draw our frame of reference. This idea was consistent with many of Jesus' teachings, where the moral ideal is ultimately found in the love of God and love of fellow man, exemplified by his own life, death, and resurrection. We need to make sure that we too see this law given at Mount Sinai through the same proper lens, to make sure that we don't let a whiff of Pharisaical thinking enter into our understanding of the law. I then moved back into the marriage discussion and showed how Jesus saw marriage as a reflection of the image of God built into the very fabric of what it meant to be human, where one male and one female would leave their families and become one in a love covenant relationship, from which new life would be generated and a new family formed. It is in this context, and this context alone, that questions of marriage and divorce should be considered and determined. One Adam, one species, one humanity made up of two equal parts, male and female, two separate genders that have psychological and physiological similarities and unique differences, and yet together a humanity made in the image of God. It is this elevation of marriage to its rightful place in intent and purpose established at the very beginning that helps us to navigate the controversies and challenges that have arisen in our society today impacting the institution of marriage. Finally, I drew attention to how Jesus did not stop the dialogue at marriage, but also addressed the value of an unmarried single life. For Jesus, an unmarried single life is just like his own, one that is without sex, but one that is a true reflection of the image of God, a fully complete and meaningful life, a life of one loved by God. Although marriage is a normative and a true reflection of the image of God, it is not the only one. A single life dedicated to the kingdom is just as meaningful and valuable to pursue. Jesus also addresses different ways an unmarried life may come about, whether through an act of others or through a lack of desire and perhaps same-sex attraction, or simply because of a choice for the sake of the kingdom. It makes no difference. All are a true reflection of the image of God. We should value and esteem those who have made this choice. Four powerful ideas: that marriage has often been distorted to please men, that the law is there to curb the excesses of human carnality and not sketch the moral ideal, that marriage is a reflection of the image of God, and that single unmarried life is equally as meaningful and God image reflecting as marriage. Four ideas that are indeed hard to take. They are indeed heavy concepts to come to terms with. It is no wonder then that Jesus ends the passage with these words: "Who is able to accept it? Let him accept it." Let us all strive to accept these words of Jesus, our Savior, made on the road to Jerusalem, made on his final journey. Let us all deeply consider and meditate on them so that we see women, the law, marriage, and single life through the same lens as Jesus, the Son of God, the very perfect image of God.